The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated April 26, 2013. And as you know, the big news in the past couple of weeks has been the bombing in Boston around the time of the Boston Marathon. And the article in The Week magazine is a bit outdated because it talks about the hunt continuing. And, of course, the suspects have been identified. One of them, well, the older brother, has been killed, and the younger one is in custody right now. So I'm going to read for you the latest article from The Week online about this particular subject. The headline of it is Sarnaev says foreign wars motivated Boston attacks. The Boston Marathon bombing suspect Dzhokhar Tsarnaev informed investigators that he and his brother were not directed by a foreign terrorist organization. Instead, they were self-radicalized and motivated to kill, in part by the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Washington Post has reported. The 19-year-old also reportedly acknowledged his role in the attack while being questioned. Tsarnaev, who has a gunshot wound to the throat and was sedated, responded in writing. Investigators have also been questioning deceased suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev's wife for details and are suspicious that Inspire, an Al-Qaeda magazine, assisted the brothers in the development of their plot. This is a very fast-moving story, as you know, and there will be more details in The Week magazine in the weeks to come. Now we'll continue with the main story section of The Week magazine. This article is entitled, A Bill for Immigration Reform. A group of Republican and Democratic senators this past week introduced long-awaited immigration legislation that would overhaul the nation's current system and provide a path to citizenship for 11 million illegal immigrants already in the country. Under the legislation, worked out over months by the bipartisan Gang of Eight, undocumented immigrants who entered the U.S. before December 31, 2011 would be eligible to apply for provisional legal status 6 months after the president signs the 844-page bill. To meet concerns of conservatives, the reforms would only apply once the federal government tightens border security standards and punishes employers who hire undocumented workers. Immigrants would also have to wait at least a decade before applying for full citizenship and the federal benefits it brings. The proposal faces months of debate and scores of possible amendments, particularly in the Republican-controlled House. Let's marvel for a moment at this bill's mere existence, said the New York Times in an editorial. As the product of a delicate balancing of competing interests, it includes some provisions that are hard to stomach. The bill throws at least $6.5 billion at a foolishly costly effort to militarize our southern border and leaves millions of people stuck in registered provisional immigrant limbo for years. But for the first time, they will be able to work and travel freely. The importance of legalizing them, erasing the crippling fear of deportation, cannot be overstated. Don't call this reform, said Fred Bauer in NationalReview.com. It's amnesty, and on an unbelievable scale. Under these proposals, millions could renew their provisional status over and over again. The expanded H-1B visa program, along with the new W visa programs for lower-skilled positions, would allow hundreds of thousands of supposedly temporary workers to enter the U.S. and bring their immediate family members with them. All conservatives get in return is a few provisions for enforcement. Face facts, said Jennifer Rubin in the WashingtonPost.com. The status quo now is amnesty. These people are already here, and they're not going home. At least these proposals get these immigrants into a system, forcing them to pass background checks, have a clean record, and pay taxes. Like all compromises, it is imperfect, but it's still very conservative-friendly. The next item from the main story section for this week is entitled Justice's Way, Gene Patents. Several U.S. Supreme Court justices expressed skepticism this week over whether companies can patent genes during a hearing that could reshape the future of the biotech industry. The court heard arguments over patents held by Myriad Genetics on two human genes, which, when mutated, give a woman a higher risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer. The patents give the Utah firm a monopoly on testing for those mutations. A lawyer for Myriad said that voiding the patents would deter other scientists and investors from trying to make advances with natural materials. But Justice Elena Kagan questioned whether, under Myriad's argument, a patent could be awarded to the first person who found a liver. And Justice Samuel Alito, a conservative, noted that while a company could patent the process used to extract a cancer treatment from a leaf, it could not patent the plant itself. Granting these absurd patents is not in the public interest, said Mark Darnofsky in the Los Angeles Times. Myriad's strict patent enforcement means its test is the only available one to determine whether a woman has a genetic variant that increases her risk of cancer. Women can't get a second opinion even when facing a decision about removing a healthy organ to lower their cancer risk. But without patent law, our life-saving tests wouldn't even exist, said Myriad CEO Peter Meldrum in USA Today. The research that led us to discover the synthetic molecules our test employs cost $500 million, an investment that took 17 years to earn back. If the Supreme Court decides a company can't own its own findings, other biotech companies will not take risks. Companies like Myriad deserve credit for the hard work involved with isolating genes, said the Sacramento Bee in an editorial. But these genes are not true inventions, which is what, what parents are meant to protect. The court should remember what Dr. Jonas Salk said when asked if he had patented his polio vaccine. There is no patent, he replied. Could you patent the sun? Now from the main story section, we'll listen to the controversy of the week. It's entitled Abortion, What the Gosnell Trial Has Revealed. Screaming 8-month-old fetuses being born alive and then beheaded. Dead babies stuffed in trash cans, jars filled with severed infants' feet. Haven't heard about these sickening accusations? It's not your fault, said Kirsten Powers in USA Today. Since the murder trial of Philadelphia abortion doctor Kermit Gosnell began last month, the mainstream media has almost entirely ignored a case that should be on every news show and front page. Gosnell, who is charged with killing 7 infants born alive and a woman who died during a botched procedure, operated a filthy charnel house where abortions were routinely carried out past Pennsylvania's 24-week limit. Births were induced in the 6th, 7th, and 8th months of pregnancy, and Gosnell then dispatched the squirming babies by sniping their spines at the neck with scissors. Liberal media outlets would have given this wall-to-wall sensational coverage if Gosnell had killed dogs, said Eric Erickson in the RedState.com. But since he only murdered babies, they largely buried their heads, fearing it would expose the true horror of legalized abortion. There is no liberal media cover-up, said Irene Carmen in Salon.com. Feminist and pro-choice columnist wrote extensively about the case when the doc was arrested in 2011, rightly observing that the butchery was a direct result of growing restrictions on safe and legal abortions. Why did poor and desperate inner-city women seek abortions from a monster? Because public funding for abortions is illegal, and Pennsylvania's strict laws greatly reduce the number of available clinics. Gosnell charged $300 instead of the $1,000 of well-run clinics, and while his customers saved up for his fee, their pregnancies moved into the sixth and seventh months, when abortion is almost always illegal. Gosnell's willingness to break the law was what made him their last chance. When these women showed up for their appointment, said Katha Polite in The Nation, they were herded like animals into blood-spattered rooms, overdosed with sedating drugs, and operated on with unsterilized equipment that spread venereal diseases and infections. Only women who felt they had no better alternative would have accepted such dangerous, degrading, and frightening treatment. But as a pro-choice woman, said Megan McArdle in the DailyBeast.com, I have to admit that journalists like me saw the Gosnell trial as bad for our side. Consciously or unconsciously, we feared what a revolted public would conclude about the morality of abortion, especially those performed late in pregnancy. People should be revolted, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. What's the moral difference between killing a living baby that is outside the mother for a few seconds and killing one that's still inside? No wonder the pro-choice media found this trial so inconvenient. If pro-choicers were less absolute in their views, said James Kirchick in the New York Daily News, they wouldn't have shied away from the Gosnell case. Too many pro-choicers, though, refuse to admit that an unborn child is anything more than a clump of cells, or that there is anything morally fraught about abortion, even late in a pregnancy. That's why this case, with its graphic evidence about fetuses that were obviously babies, presented such a threat to their belief system. The irony is that Gosnell's practices also show America what abortion was like in the coat hanger mills before Roe versus Wade, and what it will be like again if abortion ever becomes illegal. Ban abortion and you will not do away with the Kermit Gosnells. You will multiply them. Now, from the main story section of The Week magazine, let us turn to the Good Week For and Bad Week For column. It was a good week for solidarity after the New York Yankees responded to the Boston bombing by playing the informal theme song of their arch-rival Boston Red Sox, Sweet Caroline, as thousands of fans sang along. The scoreboard said, New York stands with Boston. It was a good week for ugly Saudi men after three Emirati men visiting Saudi Arabia were arrested and deported by the country's religious police, who feared they were too handsome and that female visitors could fall for them. And it was a good week for hippies after a French researcher claimed that his study of 330 women over several years revealed that wearing bras actually weakens supporting tissues and makes breasts sag more. Bras, said the researcher, are a false necessity. And it was a bad week for stereotypes after toy maker Mattel was widely mocked for its new Mexico Barbie doll, which comes with a Chihuahua dog and a passport. At least this way, Mexican Barbie won't get hounded by immigration, said Latina blogger Deborah Cruz. It was a bad week for watchdogs after a Washington State couple came home to find an intruder feeding pudding to their dog, Buddy. But when the intruder left, he called to Buddy, who followed him right out the door. And it was a bad week for cravings after police in Lapeer, Michigan, pulled over a car that was driving erratically and found a 6-year-old boy behind the wheel. The boy explained that he took his dad's car because he wanted to get some Chinese food. I don't know how he was able to operate everything and see at the same time, said a cop. Music. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section. The article this week is entitled The Bitcoin Boom. The latest online sensation is bitcoins. Could digital coins be the currency of the future? What are bitcoins? Well, they're a virtual currency invented in 2009 by a mysterious hacker who adopted a pseudonym, Satoshi Nakamoto. Angered by the 2008 financial crash, Nakamoto wanted to create a currency that would be independent of government so that a person's money could be secure from the machinations of politicians and bankers. The bitcoins themselves are all bit and no coin. There's nothing solid to hold in your hand, just a series of letters and numbers that you keep in a virtual wallet. Now, once you have them, you can exchange them online for actual goods. For falafel from Hell's Kitchen, or a hotel room in California, by going onto a website and typing in the online Bitcoin address of the recipient. Unlike U.S. dollars, euros, or other established currencies, Bitcoins are backed by no government or central bank. With Bitcoins, the transactions are purely peer-to-peer, but the movement of every single Bitcoin is tracked and publicly recorded to avoid fraud and counterfeiting. How do I get one? It's not easy. You can mine them by using highly sophisticated computers to compete against others to solve complex math problems and win the bitcoins released every 10 minutes in a sort of lottery. So far, around 11 million have been mined, and a lottery will stop when 21 million bitcoins have been generated. A much simpler way to get your hands on a Bitcoin is to just buy one from someone who already has them, usually on a currency exchange website that allows you to swap dollars for Bitcoins. Then, when you want to spend the Bitcoin, you send the agreed-upon amount to the recipient's online wallet, and off it goes. Why the sudden interest in this currency? Well, two reasons. One is that Bitcoin's value has been soaring because of what many financial experts think is an unsustainable bubble. You used to be able to buy a Bitcoin for less than a cent, but last week they briefly traded at $266 each before plunging to $55 and seesawing back and forth in the $100 range. The currency as a whole is now valued at between $1 and $2 billion, making bitcoins worth more than the currency stock of 20 separate countries, including the Seychelles, the Liberia, and Gambia. Seychelles, I believe that's pronounced. That's led some to argue that bitcoins could be a serious force in the currency market. The soaring value is tied to the second reason for Bitcoin's popularity. They tap into a growing distrust of governments and the global financial system, serving as a kind of utopian currency for young, digitally sophisticated anarchists, libertarian capitalists, and criminals who want untraceable financial transactions. It's no coincidence that Bitcoin's price rose abruptly in March at exactly the same time that the Cypriot government announced that as part of the EU bailout, it would take money out of savers' deposits. Cyprus fueled the fire of what people have felt since the financial crisis and the housing bust, said Alan Safai, a founder of a cash payment processor for bitcoins. Mistrust of government, mistrust of banking. It's enough to drive people away from the fiat currency. But how stable is a bitcoin? Well, it's not. In fact, some critics are calling bitcoins the digital equivalent of a Ponzi scheme. Bitcoin's value plummeted 77% in just 2 days last week due to technical problems with a Bitcoin exchange server, and it has experienced similar crashes in the past when servers or virtual wallets have been hacked. That volatility limits Bitcoin's appeal. How can people depend on a currency whose value can halve from one day to the next? There are also deeper problems over its legality. It's only a matter of time before U.S. officials address two major issues. First, the fact that the Bitcoin effectively competes with the U.S. dollar, thereby violating federal law. Second, that because Bitcoin transactions are anonymous, criminals are spending an estimated $2 million worth of Bitcoins a month on the black market website Silk Road, allowing users to buy and sell heroin, LSD, and other drugs without their purchases being traced. Money launderers have also gotten into the act. At some point, federal law enforcement agencies may try to shut the whole thing down. So what does the future hold? Most financial analysts argue that it's best to view bitcoins as a commodity to gamble on, like pork bellies or wheat futures, not as a serious currency. Investors seem to think the same, which is why so many hoard their bitcoins rather than choosing to spend them on pizza or iPhones, hoping that they'll be able to take advantage of the wild price swings. At some point, though, that hoarding could render the whole currency meaningless, prompting a serious crash. So like any speculative investment, people should invest in bitcoins only what they can afford to lose. It's a bit like the gold rush in California, said one currency analyst. Everyone is rushing into it and everyone is overexcited, but that makes it very risky. It should come with significant warnings of buyer beware. Now, the footnote article here for this column about bitcoins is entitled, Who is Satoshi Nakamoto? The elusive computer coder and Bitcoin inventor claims to be a 36-year-old Japanese man, yet in 2009 and 2010 he published hundreds of blog posts written in flawless English and packed full of Britishisms and British spellings. Before the invention of Bitcoin, there was no record of any coder called Satoshi Nakamoto, and the email address and website connected to his name were untraceable. He corresponded with other coders throughout Bitcoin's development, never revealing a single personal detail. Then, in 2011, he wrote that he had moved on to other things and has not been heard from since. Some have speculated that Nakamoto's real identity may be Michael Clear, a 20-something Irish cryptography grad student with experience in both currency trading and peer-to-peer technology. Clear has denied this, but in an extremely evasive way. I'm not Satoshi, he said, but even if I was, I wouldn't tell you. And now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to the Week magazine for this week. The first one is entitled Caving In to Kim's Threats by Max Boot and CommentaryMagazine.com. It was good to last, said Max Boot. Or it was too good to last, that is, when North Korea dictator Kim Jong-un first began threatening to launch military attacks on his neighbors and the U.S., the Obama administration responded with a tough, resolute stance. The U.S. put Kim on notice by flying B-2 stealth bombers on practice runs and moving warships and planes into the region. This suggested the White House had learned from the mistakes made by the Clinton and Bush administrations, which thought that offers of food aid and recognition would soothe North Korea's strategic belligerence. But this week, Secretary of State John Kerry announced that the U.S. was willing to open direct negotiations with the North and cancel deployment of U.S. anti-ballistic missiles in the region if Kim would only play nice. This is a sign of weakness and will be read as such in Pyongyang. Kerry has essentially told Kim that if he ratchets up his dangerous game, another missile launch anyone, Washington will cave in completely and grant him the concessions he sought all along. You don't negotiate with blackmailers. The next column is entitled The NRA's Most Absurd Argument by Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com. No new gun control law can prevent all future massacres. Of all the arguments against common sense gun laws made by the National Rifle Association, said Michael Tomosky, that one is clearly the dumbest. Gun rights absolutists have been insisting that there's no point in mandatory background checks and bans on assault weapons and large capacity magazines, since these restrictions couldn't guarantee the Aurora and Newtown, or that Aurora and Newtown, would never happen again. But what law prevents all lawbreaking? The Clean Water Act did not end all pollution. Laws against armed robbery don't prevent all robberies. Laws are passed to reduce, not eliminate, acts that society deems objectionable. The fact that it's impossible to design a perfect gun control law should not serve as an excuse to do nothing when psychos armed like commandos shoot up malls, schools, and movie theaters with horrifying regularity. Gun rights absolutists write off such massacres as the price for their continued access to killing machines designed for mass slaughter. The prevention canard serves as the least morally objectionable way for them to express that. No one should be deceived. And the next column is entitled, Why Continue the Cuba Embargo? By Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Cuba's communist government was about to fall until Jay-Z and Beyoncé decided to go there on vacation, said Steve Chapman. Or so you'd think, judging from the explosion of outrage over the celebrity couple's visit to Cuba under a license granted by the U.S. government. Senator Marco Rubio claimed that by circumventing the U.S. embargo on Cuba, Jay-Z and Beyoncé had propped up a cruel, repressive, and murderous regime. But the embargo has been in place for 51 years, having accomplished nothing but to give the Castro brothers a convenient scapegoat for their country's persistent poverty. The U.S., meanwhile, freely allows travelers to visit China, Vietnam, and Myanmar, which are no less cruel and repressive than Cuba, in the belief that contact will foster liberalization. Only in Cuba do we seek that end by banning contact. Meanwhile, tourists from Europe and Canada are flocking to Cuba, making the U.S.'s attempted economic strangulation of Cuba even more pointless. The embargo has been an emphatic bust. It's time we admitted it and moved on. Now we'll flip to the back of the week magazine for this week to the last word. Our article this week is entitled, In High School Forever. The self-image we develop in high school, said Jennifer Senior, can continue to define us long after graduation. Throughout high school, my friend Kenji never once spoke to the Glassmans. They were popular football-playing, handsome, identical twins. Kenji was a closeted, half-Japanese orchestra nerd who kept mainly to himself and graduated first in our class. Yet last fall, at our 25th high school reunion, Kenji grabbed Josh Glassman by his triceps, still Popeye spinach cans, and asked where the after-party was. He was only half-joking. Psychologically speaking, Kenji carries a passport to pretty much anywhere now. He's handsome, charming, a software engineer at an Amazon subsidiary. He radiates the kind of self-possession that earns instant respect. Josh seemed to intuit this. He said there was an after-party a few blocks away, and when Kenji wavered, Josh wouldn't take no for an answer. I could see there was no going back, Kenji explained the next morning. It was sort of like the dog who catches the car and doesn't know what to do with it. The party was fine, Kenji wondered if he'd been brought along as a stunt guest, a suspicion hardly allayed by Josh's announcement. I brought the valedictorian as they were arriving, though Kenji's attendance was in the same spirit, really, just in reverse. His curiosities were anthropological. He had no idea what it was like to be a football player or a cheerleader. Get out of high school, marry someone from your local area, and settle in the same area. And his conclusion by the end of the night was nothing special. It was just an ordinary party, one that might have been a little uncomfortable if we all hadn't been a little drunk. You think Kenji's underwhelmed reaction would have been reassuring, but another classmate of ours didn't take it that way. Like Kenji, Larry was brilliant, musically gifted, and hidden behind awkward glasses during most of his adolescence. Like Kenji, he too is attractive and successful today. Literally, he said, "You're saying this makes me feel I wish I'd been invited to that." Well, right, said Kenji, because that's the way high school is. Not everyone feels the sustained, melancholic presence of a high school shadow self. There are some people who put in their 4 years, graduate, and that's that. But for most adults, the adolescent years occupy a privileged space in memory, which to some degree is even quantifiable. Give an adult a series of random prompts and cues, and odds are he or she will recall a disproportionate number of memories from adolescence. The phenomenon has been found over and over. To most human beings, the significance of the adolescent years is pretty intuitive. Writers from Shakespeare to Salinger have done their most iconic work about them, and Hollywood certainly has long understood the operatic potential of proms, first dates, and the malfeasance of the cafeteria goon squad. I feel like most of the stuff I draw on, even today, is based on stuff that happened back then, says Paul Feig, the creator of Freaks and Geeks. Yet there's one class of professionals who seem to have underrated the significance of those years, and it just happens to be the group that studies how we change over the course of our lives, developmental neuroscientists and psychologists. I cannot emphasize enough the amount of skewing there is, says Pat Levitt of the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, in terms of the number of studies that focus on the early years as opposed to adolescence. For years, we had almost a religious belief that all systems developed in the same way, which meant that what happened from 0 to 3 really mattered, but whatever happened thereafter was merely tweaking. 0 to 3. For ages, this window dominated the field, and it still does today. There are good scientific reasons to focus on this time period. The sensory systems like hearing and eyesight develop very early on, but the error we made, said Levitt, was to say, oh, that's how all functions develop, even those that are very complex. Executive function, emotional regulation, all of it must develop in the same way. That is not turning out to be the case. Lawrence Steinberg, a developmental psychologist, says if you're interested in how people become who they are, so much is going on in the adolescent years. In the past couple of decades, studies across the social sciences have been designed around this new orientation. It has long been known, for instance, that male earning potential correlates rather bluntly with height. It was only in 2004 that a trio of economists thought to burrow a little deeper and discovered, based on a sample of thousands of white men in the U.S. and Britain, that it wasn't adult height that seemed to affect their subjects' wages. It was their height at 16. The sociologist Deborah Carr observed something similar about adults of a normal weight. They are far more likely to have higher self-esteem if they were a normal weight rather than overweight or obese in late adolescence. Our self-image from those years, in other words, is especially adhesive. So too are our preferences. There's no reason why at the age of 60 I should still be listening to the Allman Brothers, Steinberg says. Yet no matter how old you are, the music you listen to for the rest of your life is probably what you listened to when you were an adolescent. It turns out that just before adolescence, the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that governs our ability to reason, grasp abstractions, control impulses, and self-reflect, undergoes a huge flurry of activity, giving young adults the intellectual capacity to form an identity, to develop the notion of a self. Any cultural stimuli we are exposed to during puberty can, therefore, make more of an impression because we're now perceiving them discerningly as things to sweep into our self-concepts or reject. I am the kind of person who likes the Allman Brothers. At the same time, the prefrontal cortex has not yet finished developing in adolescence. It's still adding myelin, a substance that speeds up and improves neural connections. And until those connections are consolidated in our mid-20s, the more primitive emotional parts of the brain have a more significant influence. This explains why adolescents are such notoriously poor models of self-regulation and why they're so much more dramatic. In adolescence, the brain is also buzzing with more dopamine activity than at any other time in the human life cycle. So everything an adolescent does, everything an adolescent feels, is just a little bit more intense. If humans really do feel things most intensely during adolescence, and if they also happen to be working out an identity for the first time, then it seems safe to say this. Most American high schools are almost sadistically unhealthy places to send adolescents. Something happens when children spend so much time apart from adult company. One of the reasons that high schools may produce such peculiar value systems is precisely because the people there have little in common except their ages. These are people in a large box without any clear, predetermined way of sorting out status, says Richard Ferris, a sociologist. Such a situation, in his view, is likely to reward aggression. Absent established hierarchies and power structures, apart from the privileges that naturally accrue from being an upperclassman, kids create them on their own, and what determines those hierarchies is often the crudest common denominator stuff: looks, nice clothes, prowess in sports, rather than the subtleties of personality. The result, unfortunately, is a paradox. Those adolescents may want nothing more than to be able to define themselves. They discover that high school is one of the hardest places to do it. At the time they experience the most social fear, they have the least control. At the time they're most sensitive to the impressions of others, they're plunked into an environment where it's treacherously easy to be labeled and stuck on a shelf. Most of us, says Bren Brown of the University of Houston, opt for one of three strategies to cope with the pain this causes. We move away from it by secret keeping, by hiding. We move toward it by people pleasing. Or we move against it by using shame and aggression to fight shame and aggression. Whichever strategy we choose, she says, the odds are good we will use it for life. In high school, said Winnie Holtzman, the creator of My So-Called Life, we become pretty convinced that we know what reality is. We know who looks down on us, who is above us, exactly who our friends and our enemies are. The truth of the matter, says Holtzman, is that we really have no clue. What seems like unshakable reality is basically just a story we learned to tell ourselves. Ferris's research on aggression may help account for adolescents' distorted understanding of their social world. One of his findings is obvious. The more concerned kids are with popularity, the more aggressive they are. But another finding isn't. Kids become more vulnerable to aggression as their popularity increases, unless they're at the very top of the status heap. It's social combat, he explains. Think about it. There's not much instrumental value to gossiping about a wallflower. There's value to be gossiping about your rivals. The higher kids climb, in other words, the more precariously balanced they feel, unless they're standing on the square head of the totem pole. It therefore stands to reason that many popular kids don't see themselves as popular, or at least feel less powerful than they loom. Their perch is too fragile. Maybe, perversely, we should be grateful that high school prepares us for life. The isolation, the shame, the aggression from those years, all of it readies us to cope. But one also has to wonder whether high school is to blame, whether the worst of adult America looks like high school because it's populated by people who went to high school in America. High school does something to us, is the point. We bear its stripes. Psychologist Joseph Allen found that the kids who suffer from mild depression at 14, 15, and 16 have worse odds in the future in romance, friendship, competency assessment by outsiders, even if their depression disappears and they become perfectly happy adults. Because it's their first template for adult interaction, says Allen, and once they're impaired socially, it carries forward. I went to my high school reunion curious about whom people had become. There were the football players still acting like they owned the joint, but as more generous proprietors. There were the beautiful girls, still beautiful but looking less certain about themselves. I was happy to see a lot of them. We'd all grown more gracious. Many of us had bloomed, and it was strangely moving to be among people who all shared this shameful, grim, and wild common bond. I imagined how much nicer it would have been to see all those faces if we hadn't spent our time together in that red brick linoleum tiled perdition. Then again, if we hadn't, I probably wouldn't have cared. And that's the article written by Jennifer Senior in 2013 by New York Magazine. Now, from the last word in the Week magazine for this week, we will flip to the health and science section. Our first article today is entitled, The Real Danger of Red Meat. Eating lots of red meat increases your risk of heart disease, but fat and cholesterol are not the only culprits. Researchers have discovered that a chemical in red meat called carnitine promotes a type of gut bacteria that in turn produces a compound called TMAO that literally hardens arteries. When researchers fed steaks to a group of regular meat eaters and a vegan and tested their blood, they found that TMAO levels spiked in the meat eaters but not in the vegan. The reason, confirmed by a broader study, is that vegans have fewer of the gut bacteria that convert carnitine into TMAO. The bacteria living in our digestive tracts are dictated by our long-term dietary patterns, Cleveland Clinic researcher Stanley Hazen tells Bloomberg.com. A diet high in carnitine actually shifts our gut microbe composition, making meat eaters even more susceptible to forming TMAO and its artery-clogging effects. Figuring out which microbe species are responsible for increasing TMAO levels might lead to antibiotics that could prevent heart disease. Until then, Hazen recommends creating a healthier gut ecosystem by eating less red meat. I used to have the red meat 5 days out of seven, he says. Now I have cut it back to less than once every 2 weeks or so. The next article is entitled, A Hint of Dark Matter. Less than a year after spotting the Higgs boson, physicists are closing in on another elusive component of the universe, dark matter. Researchers analyzing data collected by the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, an instrument bolted onto the International Space Station, say they've detected what may be the first solid evidence of the mysterious stuff. Until now, the chief sign of dark matter's existence has been the gravitational pull it appears to exert on stars and galaxies, keeping the universe from expanding more quickly. We live in a sea of dark matter, Michael Solomon, a physicist at the U.S. Department of Energy, tells NPR.org. Scientists have calculated that dark matter makes up 27% of the universe, yet they know little about it. Researchers believe that when particles of dark matter collide, the resulting energy creates detectable particles called positrons. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer has so far detected 400,000 positrons that appear to be the products of such collisions, and researchers hope analysis will unlock new insights. If we detect dark matter and learn something about its nature, Solomon says, we will have made a major impact to our understanding of physics and nature itself. The next article in the health and science section in the week is A Machine That Sees Dreams. Japanese researchers have managed to partially decode dreams by scanning the brains of sleepers. Researchers used magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs, to monitor the brain activity of three volunteers as they drifted off. They awakened them some 200 times as soon as they started dreaming to ask what they'd seen. Then they programmed a computer to search for patterns in brain activity that corresponded to specific images, say a human face, both while the subjects were asleep and awake. When they ran the program on the volunteers as they dreamed again, the researchers were able to predict what images they were seeing 60% of the time. We are all intrinsically interested in dreaming, but neuroscientists to this day aren't certain what it does for us, Jack Gallant, a neuroscientist at the University of California in Berkeley, tells the LA Times. This new program may be the first step, he says, toward a dream decoder that would create a movie on your television screen, and it would just replay your dreams. Those movies might not be as riveting as you'd expect, says study author Yukiyoshi Kamitani. Many of his subjects' dreams, he said, were just about daily life in the office. And now the health scare of the week, isolation can kill. Social isolation can substantially shorten your life. A new 7-year study of 6,500 British people over the age of 52 found that those who were the most socially isolated were 26% more likely to die during the study period than were those who were the most engaged, regardless of whether they reported feeling lonely. Social connections can provide emotional support and warmth, which is important, but they also provide things like advice, such as making sure people take their medication. University College London psychologist Andrew Steptoe tells bbc.co.uk, there are plenty of people who are socially isolated, but who are perfectly happy with that. But even then, we should be trying to make sure there's enough contact with them so that if something goes wrong, they're going to be advised and supported. Research shows that physical contact, such as hand-holding, can also improve health by lowering blood pressure, stress hormone levels, and inflammation. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, Accidental Racist, A Plea for Tolerance. Brad Paisley can hold a tune, said Melissa Locker in Time.com, but the country singer's recent attempts to heal the nation's continuing racial tensions was way off key. Paisley's new song, Accidental Racist, attempts to start a conversation about race relations, but has been widely denounced as ignorant and, yes, racist. In the song, Paisley argues that white Southerners should be allowed to celebrate their region's history, and that when he wears a Confederate flag, it's because he's a proud rebel son, not a racist. It ain't like you and me can rewrite history, he croons to a fictional black man in the song. We're still paying for mistakes that a bunch of folks made long before we came. Paisley wants us all to just get along, said Aisha Harris in Slate.com, implying that the country's racial issues are based solely on a 150-year-old grudge. But in the South, some high schools still hold separate proms for blacks and whites, while the jails are full of African Americans. If he's going to take on a topic as complex as racism, Paisley shouldn't be so superficial and ultimately so dismissive. Paisley's song might be a bit naive, said Alan Shearstall in VillageVoice.com, but give the guy a break. Why not cheer when America's top male country star challenges his many fans to put themselves in black people's shoes? Clumsy as the song is, at least it's an honest attempt to reconcile Southern pride with white guilt. Its heart is in the right complex place. I have no problems with Southern pride, said Touré in Time.com, but Paisley's defense of the Confederate flag only underscores his ignorance. The flag of the Confederacy is not just a relic of history, but a symbol of slavery and white supremacy, and black America will always recognize it as such. Paisley also gives himself a pass when he sings, "It ain't like I can walk a mile in someone else's skin," said Leonard Pitts Jr. in the Miami Herald. Is it really so impossible for a white man to understand what, say, a Confederate flag means to the descendants of slaves, or to empathize with anyone, black, Hispanic, Muslim, who suffers prejudice? To understand others, just open your mind, your heart, and your ears. Arguing that whites are locked into their own perspectives and are only racist by accident is a cop-out and a disappointment. The next article is entitled, "Taxes, Are We Paying Too Much?" "Hate your income tax rate? Join the club," said Danielle Kerselben in USNews.com. As Americans dutifully filed their 1040s last week, just 55% told Gallup that their income taxes were fair, the lowest number in 12 years, and almost half thought their tax bill was too high. "Ordinary Americans have every right to feel aggrieved," said Joseph Stiglitz in the New York Times, "because put simply, the very rich don't pay their fair share. As we learned from Mitt Romney's tax returns, multimillionaires take outrageous advantage of a loophole-filled tax code that gives them lower rates for capital gains earnings and big deductions for vacation homes and so-called business expenses. After years of playing on this tilted playing field, the wealthiest 1% now owns 40% of the nation's wealth, but paid just 20% of all taxes in 2010. That leaves middle-class families shouldering the bulk of the cost for defense, road building, safety net programs, and education. The rich hardly escape paying their fair share," said John Cochran in the Wall Street Journal. "When state, local, and property taxes are added to the federal state tax, along with stealth taxes on everything from booze to cigarettes to airplane tickets, some successful people can pay upwards of 60% or more. That's confiscatory. A fairer tax code would include an alternative maximum tax, so once you've paid, say, 50% of your income in taxes, you've done your bit, and federal income taxes can take no more. People would also feel better about paying taxes if they could decide how some of their dollars are spent," said Elizabeth Dunn in the New York Times. "Supporters of the military could direct 10% of their taxes to the Pentagon, for example, while lovers of opera and fine art could earmark taxes for the National Endowment for the Arts." "Maybe we should also start appreciating what our taxes buy," said Richard Esko in HuffingtonPost.com. "Did you learn to read and do math in a public school? Taxes paid for that. Use the internet? You're using a technology invented with tax dollars. And let's not forget the greatest tax benefit of all. You're alive. You didn't die of smallpox, polio, or other diseases eradicated or held in check by public health programs. And you weren't murdered in a lawless community unprotected by police. In a democracy, the they who receive the benefits of tax dollars are us." The next article, Rand Paul, the GOP's outreach to blacks. "I'm not the world's leading Rand Paul fan," said David Frum in the DailyBeast.com, "but good for him for speaking at Howard University. The Republican senator from Kentucky and Tea Party hero last week reached out to African-American voters in a speech at the historically black college, pitching the merits of the GOP and libertarianism to a skeptical audience. I come to Howard today not to preach or prescribe some special formula for you," said Paul, "but to say I want a government that leaves you alone." That got a chilly response, but Paul got a warmer reception when he portrayed a school choice as a civil rights cause and advocated the repeal of harsh drug laws that had locked so many young black men in prison. "How could it be," Paul asked, "that the party of Abraham Lincoln and emancipation was now so out of favor with black voters?" "It's a patronizing question," said Adam Server in MotherJones.com, and throughout his lame speech, Paul condescended to his audience. He tried to whitewash his own stated opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and commended himself for being brave or crazy enough to speak in such an obviously dangerous environment, that is, a college full of black people. At least we now know Paul's strategy for expanding the Republican Party's appeal, said Jack White in TheRoot.com. Amnesia. There was no mention of the Southern strategy that Richard Nixon and other Republicans used to win white votes for decades, or Ronald Reagan's attacks on welfare queens and coded support for states' rights. Paul may find it convenient to forget that Republicans effectively embraced racism from 1964 on, but African Americans haven't. And now, as we reach the end of our program for this week, we'll take a look at a few shorter items in the Talking Points section. The percentage of private companies offering health care coverage to employees has dropped steadily since 2000, and in 2011, only 52% of private sector workers had health coverage through their employers. The average premium for a single employee doubled during that time. Since the Newtown shootings, five states have passed seven laws strengthening gun control. 10 have passed 17 laws extending gun rights, including laws that authorize guns in churches, teachers to be armed, and employees to bring guns to workplaces as long as they store them in their cars. Americans spent $50.4 billion on state lottery tickets and video kiosks in 2009. Households will take home incomes of less than $13,000, spent on average $645 a year on lottery tickets, about 9% of their income. 11 states raise more from lotteries than from corporate taxes. The massive new headquarters of the Department of Homeland Security, scheduled to be completed in 2023, will cost $3.9 billion and house 17,000 employees. And since the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act for financial reform, the nation's 20 largest banks have met 1,298 times with federal officials to debate the 400 rules needed to implement the law. Two-thirds of those rules are still being worked on. And the poll watch for this week, 55% of Americans believe that it is possible to pass new gun control laws without interfering with Second Amendment rights. 86% say they support requiring background checks on those buying guns at shows or online, and 56% support a national ban on high-capacity ammunition clips. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.